Thanks, Jacob. Thanks, worship team. As the plates are starting to come down the aisle, I want to get started. We've got a lot of good, I think, information discussion for this morning when it comes to this issue of poverty. We're focusing on it all month long. And when I talk about poverty, it's going to bring up different kinds of emotions or experiences, philosophies, even theologies within us as people, as we each relate or have positions when it comes to the issue of poverty. Poverty is something that has been with mankind as long as there has been mankind, and it has been the goal of countless generations, not just, you know, here in America with the different policies and programs that we have, but it has been the goal of countless generations to end poverty wherever it has been. But there has never been an answer to the issue that has ended poverty. Some people believe when it comes to poverty that it is a money issue. There's not enough, there needs to be more, it will solve that problem. Others see it as a cultural issue, that it has something to do with the people in it, the people themselves. Some say it's a motivational issue, that if someone would just, you know, do a little more, make some better decisions, they get out of their situation. Others see it as a victimization issue, that the person is benign to it and it's the system. They're a victim of the system, and that's what poverty is and why there are poor. And you probably fall into at least one of these categories, and the diversity of beliefs as to why poverty is there, what causes it, really create a problem when it comes to the answer to poverty, because we're all looking at it differently, coming at it from different perspectives, which then the solution to it is going to be vastly different as well. And, you know, that's part of what makes poverty this perpetual existence in our culture, is a lack of understanding or really coming together on what poverty is. But if I were to ask a question to maybe help you, help us identify or understand where we are personally on this issue, I might ask one of two questions. I'm not going to ask for your answers, just for yourself. One of these two questions you're going to resonate with more than the other when it comes to the issue of poverty. So the first one I would ask is this. Is poverty the result of poor decisions on the part of the poor? Now, if you're following along with the program you were handing out, these are your first fill-ins this morning. Is poverty the result of poor decisions on the part of the poor? In other words, if they made better decisions, they didn't make poor decisions, they wouldn't be in poverty. Or the second question, maybe you resonate with this question better. Is poverty the result of a system that limits what decisions can be made, which is then compounding the impact of the poor decisions? Maybe you're a mixture of the two. Maybe you see truth in both, or maybe you see fallacy in both of those questions. When you boil it down, most people fall into one or two categories like this that then stem, or from that flows their own philosophies when it comes to poverty and how they want to address it. But people either see poverty as an issue with the person, and others see it as an issue with a system that a person is in. And as we look at this issue of poverty, we're going to be looking at it from a lot of different angles over these next 4 weeks, and we're going to be looking at it locally right here in Sioux Falls, as well as within our country, globally. The issue of poverty, though, there are maybe different, unique reasons why there's poverty. The overarching nemesis of poverty is going to be very similar. So once we understand it, we can address it, then in different places you find it, the answer is can be found, or the answer to solving or resolving that poverty situation can be found within that context. So we're going to do our best to do this during this series. Obviously, it is a large task. And when we talk about poverty, what are we saying? I didn't put on the screen, or I don't have on the screen for you a definition of poverty. But poverty certainly is not having what you need. And when you don't have what you need, you are then poor. But poverty is not so much a person. To be poor, you could be poor, but you are in a system or you are experiencing poverty. Poverty can be not having enough food. That's probably something we connect with the most. Someone is hungry, and so they are poor, and they are in poverty because they don't have enough food. But it's really wherever you don't have a voice or control or you don't have the things that you need. So just kind of a basic list, I think any of us would agree that we don't want someone to be hungry. We also don't want someone to not have adequate shelter or access to education or access to health care or protection, that they wouldn't have protection from violence, or even not have a voice in what happens in their community. These are all different angles of poverty, but, you know, and we may have them on one level or another. But when we're talking about this idea of poverty, we have to understand, first of all, that God created us all equal. So there's not the haves and have-nots in the kingdom of God. We're all created on an equal playing field, but we also all live in a world that is not fair and equal, right? In other words, some people are born into poverty and some people are not. And there is not a fair quotient you can put to that. You had no say in what system you were born into, correct? I mean, you know, you weren't around to make that choice. You're just born to, you know, into a family, into a certain culture at a certain time in world history. And if you're born into poverty or you're born into wealth, let's say, there are challenges as well as blessings or even benefits in either one of those camps. But you don't, like, you're not responsible for how you came into it. And we're created equal, but we don't live in this fair or equal world, and poverty exists throughout the world. And poverty is not getting better, it's getting worse as a whole in the world around us. So God created us equal, but things are not equal in our world. You can't be responsible for how you were born into money or lack thereof. There are certainly opportunities and challenges in either way that you might come into this world. But I believe that that is why there is this call from God for those that have some kind of means to be able to help those that do not. And the minute I say that, some of you are immediately thinking, oh my goodness, is Pastor Doug now going to talk about redistribution of wealth? I didn't say that. That might be a philosophy that's out there. But the Bible is going to talk very specifically in many different instances about the issue of poverty, and redistribution of wealth is not one of the things that the Bible would put out there saying this is the answer to poverty. But it does say that if you have means, that you should be helping those that don't have means. But it's the choice of the person. It is the way that you are going to live life as a follower of Christ, and it's going to look differently in each household or in each community or each culture that you find yourself in. But it also, the Bible is going to teach that the idea isn't to give what it is that you have worked hard for to someone who is unwilling to work hard or unwilling to take care of themselves. The Bible wouldn't promote this idea of unhealthy support, where you're financially supporting someone who has the capability of supporting themselves. That's an unhealthy relationship. In fact, Proverbs says, you know, the borrower is slave to the lender. It creates this power struggle between people, with those the haves and have-nots, and can keep people in a situation of poverty in the way that might take place. In fact, in 2 Thessalonians, it says this. It says, even while we were with you, we gave you this command. Those unwilling to work will not get to eat. This is similar advice that you would have gotten from your mom or maybe your grandparents or someone in your life that kind of understood how life goes. If you want something, you're going to need to work for it. If you want to provide better for yourself, you need to be willing to work hard for it. If you don't want to work hard in life, you're going to eat top ramen. And if you work hard, you're going to get to eat prime rib, or whatever your cut might be. That's what we're taught, And that seems to be the system that we live under, that you just need to work for it. The Bible would say, if you work for your money, great, but you should be giving. At the same point, you shouldn't be giving to those that are capable to work on their own. In fact, the key word here is unwilling. They're unwilling to work. Because when people do have the means to care for themselves and you do that thing for them, you're actually hurting them. We're going to discuss this a whole lot more in week 3 when we're going to talk about toxic charity or how when helping hurts a person. And so we're going to discuss a little bit more week 3 on that. But the person who is doing that is not someone who is poor. It is a person who is lazy. And that is not all poor people. But there are some people in our world, and has always been, that has not done for themselves what they could do, and as a result, they don't have. And when the expectation is that someone else then provides it when they are capable to, that is an unhealthy relationship, and the scripture would teach us that those are not the ones that we should be charitable to. Poverty is not a choice. Laziness can be a choice. But poverty is not a choice. And God even says that there should be no poor among you. Those that don't have because of poverty. Because as Christians, we should make sure that there is no poverty. In Deuteronomy chapter 15, verses 4 through 5, it says this. There should be no poor among you. See, that's where I got it from. I just make this stuff up. For the Lord your God will greatly bless you in the land that he is giving you as a special possession, and you will receive the blessing if you are careful to obey all the commands of the Lord your God that I am giving you today. You see, there is blessing for those who take God's commands seriously. And how can we as a people say that we love if we let someone starve when we have means to help them? How can we say that we love if we allow someone to starve when we do have the means to help them? In fact, in 1 John chapter 3, verse 17, I want to read this verse for you, but I want to read it out of the Message. Eugene Peterson wrote the Message Bible. It's a paraphrase, but I really like the language at the end of this verse. He said this. He says, if you see some brother or sister in need and have the means to do something about it, but turn a cold shoulder and do nothing, what happens to God's love? It disappears. And you made it disappear. Those are sobering words for us as followers of Christ. God loves all his people. Equality amongst his people. When it comes to salvation, it comes to their worth, their value to him. But in this world, things are not fair. And even when Jesus was teaching on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, what's called the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, verse 3, Jesus said these words. He said, God blesses those who are poor and realize their need for him, for the kingdom of heaven is theirs. And this is a two-part word when it says poor, because not only is it poor in spirit, like what is poor in spirit? Each one of us have been poor in spirit at some time where we just go through difficult times. Our faith is weak. We've been rocked. We're disappointed. We're depressed. In our spirit, there's just a weakness in us. And in that poverty of our spirit, the kingdom of heaven is ours. God is still on the throne. There is hope. But the word also is connected to what you don't have even physically. So you may not have it spiritually, but maybe you don't have physically as well. And you are in a place of poverty. The kingdom of heaven is for those people too. I think all of us in one way or another find ourselves in poverty. Differently than maybe what we would say when we're rating the economic position of a person, whether they're in poverty or not. But I think we all find ourselves in poverty, either at stages in our life or in different ways where we don't have the things that we need. Not the things just that we want, but truly the things that we need. We find ourselves not having what we need in a place of poverty. Look, the whole of Scripture, when you look at the whole of Scripture, who is it written to? Who is the Bible, what kind of people is the Bible written to? Your next fill-in, I would propose this, that the Bible was primarily written by, for, and to oppressed people. That oppression, not having, not being able, this idea of poverty. that people who didn't have what they needed, they didn't have the protection that they needed, they didn't have the resources they needed, they didn't have the freedoms that they needed, they wrote the scriptures. And they wrote it for people that were oppressed, and they wrote it to people who were oppressed. See, God doesn't just ask us to care about poverty today or tomorrow, but this idea of caring about poverty is the way a Christian is supposed to live their life, that we care about those that don't have, those that are oppressed, those that are missing what it is that they need. It's a way of life that we live. And the way Scripture teaches is it's a way that we live in which poverty is no longer something that should rule anyone's life. And this is certainly going to require a different approach to poverty than perhaps what we are used to doing or hearing. So here is a guiding question or a guiding principle for all of us to consider as we think about poverty and our personal approach to addressing it. Here's the question. Am I trying to change a person when it comes to addressing poverty, or am I trying to change a system? Is it about a person or a system, which kind of relates to the first two questions we started with? Are you trying to change a person when you're addressing poverty, or is there a system that you're addressing? And maybe there's a mixture for you of those things. Our Western ideas of poverty, really over about the last 56, 57 years since this initial research has been done, are based on the idea, at least all of the systems and programs we currently have going, not only in our government, but even within the church, are based on the belief that a person's poor decisions are the cause for their poverty. That poor decisions that they make are the result of their poverty. And if we believe this, then we end up wanting to solve the issue of poverty by addressing the decisions so that better decisions can be made and then they will no longer be in poverty. I mean, it seems simple, right? You know, you make a poor decision and that decision is going to lead to poverty or to even more poverty. This can create kind of an us versus them mentality where we would say, you know, we are not poor. You know, I am not poor because I am making good decisions. And they, whoever they are poor because, well, they're making poor decisions. We are okay. They are not okay. Systemically, they're not okay. You see, you cut your lawn, they don't cut their lawn. You change the oil in your car, they don't change the oil in their car. You finished high school, they did not finish high school. You have a college education, they do not have a college education. It's about their choices. That's the way we would look at it under this Western idea of poverty. The poverty is about a person making poor choices, and those poor choices keep them in poverty. In America, in its coldest sense, it would sound a little like this. White middle-class people make the right decisions, and ethnic poor make the wrong decisions. In other words, if you want to not be in poverty, just be more like us. Do things like us. Make our decisions. In fact, it's not just your decisions, but it's really a change of the entire person. Not just your choices, but who you are. If you're more like us, then you're not going to have the problem. And if you think about and look at the ways that we're trying to help people that are in poverty, it is based on getting them to make decisions like we would make, because they're the right decisions, right? I mean, that's the whole point. And we really want them to become more like us. You have to understand the system. You have to be a part of the system. You have to embrace that system, which is why we have horrific stories in our history. Like when the church came into the New Americas and to Native Americans decided that the way to help them was to cut their hair and put on white man clothes and make them into something that they weren't, because that would move them from savage to civilized. How'd that work out? And honestly, I'd say, how is the whole way that we're addressing poverty working out? Is it getting better or worse? The data would say it's getting worse across the board, and we're putting more effort into it than any culture previously that has been recorded for us. We're putting more dollars, more energy. There are more programs trying to address this, and yet there are more and more people every year in poverty. something's broken, something's not right. There seems to be this vacuum, this black hole of our efforts. Now, obviously, there are some grains of truth in this idea that poor people make poor decisions. There is some grain of truth in this. Maybe it's true in all of our lives, but like here's a simple example. Someone that is in poverty and has somehow been able to acquire a vehicle, and let's say not only do they have a vehicle, but they have insurance for this vehicle, and this vehicle is running, it comes time for a need for an oil change. And a person in poverty will say, I do not have the $30 to do an oil change. Well, see, someone that's not in poverty would say that is a poor decision. Why? Because if you don't do the oil change, $4,000, $8,000, $12,000, I talked to one guy, had been like over 20-some-odd thousand miles since he'd done an oil change. I thought, wow, what kind of oil did you put in originally? I want to know. Because at some point, the oil will stop doing what oil does, and the engine will blow. How much will that cost? $3,000? So you would say to not do the $30 oil change is a poor decision because it's going to cost you $3,000 down the line, and now you won't have a vehicle, now you won't get to your job, everything starts to fall apart. That is a poor decision. But to someone that doesn't have the $30, what do they do? So you see, there are some grains of truth in it where you would say, you know, if you did this, it would be better for you down the line. So here's some advice. But to think that poverty exists only because people make poor decisions is to miss the whole reason why poverty is there in the first place. Because when you start to believe that all people are poor because they make poor decisions, it then allows us who think that way to assess all poverty as that lazy thing that God speaks against because they could change their situation if they would choose to change. So now we can say they're poor because of poor decisions. They could make better decisions. They're choosing not to, so I don't have to care about their poverty because it's a result of their own choices, which is why Christians as a whole across the U.S. and even around the world can hear about horrible situations of poverty and never raise an eyebrow and never be concerned about it because it's this idea that it's a result of poor people making poor decisions and they could make a different decision. So I don't have to know about it. I don't have to get involved with it. I don't have to care about it because systematically, poor people are poor because of their poor decisions. And all attempts to address it are just to get them to make better decisions. All programs, all efforts, all dollars go to provide the need and then at best help them make a better decision. I think we also begin to believe with this mindset that our lives and actions have nothing to do with the source of someone else's poverty. We're going to get to that a little bit more in the weeks to come. As if our choices or the way we live our lives don't cause, perpetuate, or add to someone's poverty. In fact, if anything, we would say that we are an example to follow. We're what you should do differently. And this is what we in the West believe. This is what is taught really within the types of programs that are in the church today. And though there are grains of truth to all of this, it is wrong. Now, if you know me, I am a data guy. I don't get emotionally invested or moved or impassioned by a series of video or photographs with some heartfelt piano music playing in the background. I know some people, they watch that and like they get emotional and it moves them to action. It does nothing for me. There are people that are close to me that say, are you dead inside? I say, no, I'm a data person. So you can't get me with an emotional response, but I have shed a tear over an Excel spreadsheet. Because in that spreadsheet, it will show me the data that will confront and change something that I've always believed, because here is the raw data that proves that what I thought was wrong and something else is real. And when it comes to the issue of poverty, this happened to me. Because I was along the mindset of everyone else that poor people make poor decisions. And I was transformed by data that showed me that my belief system, as much as I wanted to hold to it, was not correct. In fact, show me proof and I will act accordingly. Some people, when it comes to those in poverty, say, you know, well, poor people are lazy and they don't go to work. We just lump all people of poverty in that. They don't work. Well, if that's true, the research from the Economic Policy Institute is very confusing. Because what they did is they looked at kids that are on free and reduced programs in school, and then they looked at those families, those homes that they came from, and this is what they discovered. So these are people in poverty that fall underneath that poverty line here in America, and they discovered this, that 83% of children from low-income families had at least one employed parent. And we wouldn't think that otherwise. 83%. I mean, that's a pretty darn high number compared to what most people think about people in poverty. In fact, in those families, also 60% had at least one full-time employed parent. So maybe a full-time and a part-time, but at least one full-time. Here's another piece of information that came out. When we look at, how much effort people in poverty put towards their work, the data revealed this also, that the poor working adults spend more hours working than their wealthier counterparts. Those in poverty were at work more hours than those that were higher up in their wealth. We don't think of it that way. Like, across the board, people in poverty work more hours than those that aren't in poverty, that are wealthier. Then stepping away from kids and looking at all people in poverty, all people, this data showed that 63% of people in poverty are working, and 44% are working full-time jobs across the board. And I know that when I show this data, some of you are seeing it the way that I used to see it. Because I certainly wouldn't have celebrated that second to the bottom where I'd say 63% of people in poverty are working. I would miss the 63% and I would think of the 37% that weren't working, right? And you go, see, that's the problem. 37% of them aren't working. That's where the problem is. Do you realize that this data is saying that if you're a person in poverty, 63% of people in poverty are working and are remaining and staying in poverty? 44% are working a full-time job and still remaining in poverty. Is that okay? Forget about the number that's beyond that. Realize that people in poverty can work a full-time job and work more hours than you and remain in poverty. Something is broken in the system, not the person. You can say it's the person because you don't want to look at the 63% or the 44%. You want to look at those that aren't working. I get that. But look at the ones that are. There's something in the system that we're not seeing, something in the system that is keeping people in a place of poverty differently than what we think, that it's just poor decisions. But that's just work, right? Because you're saying, okay, but Doug, like, come on. We know how they live their lives. It's those other choices that keep them in poverty. Like, poor people do not value education. If they valued education, then their kids would get that education and they would break the cycle of poverty. But they don't value it. Well, the Compton Lilly did research on that very specific issue because a lot of people feel that way. And they discovered that low-income parents value education the same way wealthy parents do. No distinction between poverty and wealthy when it came to the value a parent had on education. And you can say, it's not true. Well, the data says that is true. So unless you can do and prove data otherwise. I also find it so interesting how so many of us have these strong feelings about people in poverty and we don't know any. But we have strong feelings about all these people in poverty. well, you know, people in poverty do a lot of drugs. They spend their money on drugs, and because of drugs, they're just not effective. They're not good workers on the hours that they're there because drugs are a big issue. Poor people do a lot of drugs. Well, the data would say that drug use is equally distributed across the classes. Low-income class, middle class, high class, drug use the same across all classes. There's not one class, one group of people that does drugs more than another. Certainly, the types of drugs, that may change with certain classes, but interestingly, that's not even a big factor. They're all equally across the class. It's not that poor people are doing drugs more than any other person is doing drugs. You say, well, what about alcohol? That's a big one, alcohol. The data shows from the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, they showed their hard data that wealthy people are far more likely than poor people to abuse alcohol. It's not the poor people abusing it, it's the people above that. And do you know why? Like, it is super simple. Alcohol is expensive. So if you're going to try and numb yourself in some way, a poor person can't do it through alcohol. It's just too expensive to do it that way. So alcoholism is more prevalent in wealthier people than in just in poor people, but that's not what we think or what we've been taught or what we believe. You see, you cannot find a set of values among poor people that make them poor. It's not like one set of values. So let's just address this. You can't find a set of common behaviors amongst poor people that make them poor. And my challenge or my kind of direction as we're looking at this is this, is that the root of the problem isn't poor people. The root of the problem is poverty. And God has called us, as followers of Christ, to end poverty. And if we keep looking at poverty as being people, we're going to continue to miss the mark on how to solve and address the issue of poverty. In fact, I would say we're going to continue to hire Christian stunt people. Like, what are Christian stunt people? Years ago, I heard someone share this, and it really stuck with me. But he had said, you know, as Christians, you think of like stunt people, like if you're an actor and you are, you know, going out and making a movie and you have to jump out of a, you know, 20-story building, the actor actually, surprise, doesn't jump out of that window. I know it seems like it. And I know, you know, various actors like Tom Cruise does a lot of his own stunts, but 20-story building, he ain't doing it. They're going to hire a stunt double to jump out of that 20-story window, and he'll run to the window, it'll cut away, and then it'll back up, and you'll see some guy go flying out of the window. That ain't Tom Cruise, okay? Tom Cruise is not going to risk his life, get dirty, get messy, do that stunt. He's going to stay pristine because he's got another movie he wants to make. Well, and he wants to live. You see, in our Christian communities, many times we are always looking for a stunt double. We're like, I'm a follower of Christ, and I need to address poverty. So there are single moms that need diapers, so I'm going to go out and buy diapers, but now I'm going to look for my stunt double. So I'm going to find an organization that gives diapers to single moms, and I'm going to give those diapers to that organization, who is then going to be the boots on the ground and make connection with those moms and get the diapers to them. That's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. But if that's our mentality always, never to get dirty and let someone else do it, the problem is you're never going to see poverty. You're never going to experience it. You're never going to know it. Poverty will never have a name. It's just going to be this thing that's out there. You know, we find ministries that are doing well or that are helping, that are providing, you know, education for people in poverty, and we give money to it, but we don't volunteer there. We don't do it. Now, I'm not just globalizing. Many of you are doing these things, and it's wonderful. And if all you are doing is helping financially, please keep doing that, because they definitely need that. But we need to find places where we get in the face of poverty, where poverty has a name. I was talking to another guy who poverty was always this thing, and one day he stopped under the underpass where all these homeless people were living, and he started going there every single day, and he met this guy and got to know him. And while being out there, it started to rain, and everybody there scattered and jammed into this one area of this overpass. And he said, what is going on? He says, this is the only place where we don't get wet with the wind and everything. And he says, if it happens at night, we all huddle together. And so this guy, I don't remember what the homeless person's name was. We'll just call him Bob, let's say. This guy said that all of a sudden poverty had a name for him, and it was Bob. And when he was at home and the rain poured, even though he lived in a different state at this point, he couldn't help but think of that group that at that very moment was running to huddle, and it was Bob. And it transformed the way he thought about poverty because it had a name. We've got to get ourselves in the place where our hearts and our care and our conviction and our passions and our resources are connected with a name, and not just a ministry or something that's out there that's benign but really impacts and touches people. You see, the church needs to stop exporting Jesus and start being Jesus. Because you're never going to understand poverty until you can see it. You're never going to understand the poor until you know someone who is poor and until you walk poverty with them. You see, when your kid comes home from school and it's time to do homework, you know, they can pick up a pencil and they can do their homework. But a kid in poverty, a poor kid, comes home, he may not have that pencil. You say, well, what's the big deal of not having a pencil? Well, if you don't have a pencil and that you, there's no writing instrument in the house, how would you do your homework? You know, and that kid, as he comes home, he doesn't have a pencil to do his homework, but what's going to even motivate him to do his homework in the first place? Because his mom is working that full-time job. Maybe she's working two jobs. And not only that, but maybe it's taking her, you know, an hour plus to and from work on the bus system, which is what it takes here in Sioux Falls, to go from point A to point B. There are certain bus routes, depending on where you live, on the bus route, to go to a place on the bus route that on average takes an hour and a half. To and from work. Can you imagine if your commute was an hour and a half? And so if she's not there, how's that kid going to do his homework? How's he going to be motivated? I know you're like, because that would be a good decision. Poor decision is not doing your homework. So poor kids need to do their homework. How's your kid at doing homework if you're not there to say, do your homework? Mine weren't any good at it. And we had lots of pencils. But see, this mom doesn't. She doesn't even know that she doesn't have the pencil. And she comes home at what? 8 p.m., 9 p.m. from her job at Smithfield? Then when she gets home, she still has to make dinner. Maybe she still has to pick up stuff for dinner. And then that's when she asks, did you do your homework? And the kid's like, can't find a pencil. Well, where's she going to get a pencil at 9? The bus system isn't working. There's no pencil store on her block. Is she going to go door to door and start knocking and trying to find a pencil? She also has laundry still to do. Maybe tomorrow she can figure out how to get the pencil and bring it home after work that day. But see, we can't imagine a life without a pencil. It doesn't even register to us. So we spend all our energy making sure kids have Chromebooks. Can you imagine what that's like in that family? A Chromebook? I don't have Wi-Fi. I don't have pencils. If I gave you a Rubik's Cube, you know, a blast from the past, the 80s, and I told all of you, you have 15 minutes to solve this Rubik's Cube or you die. How many of you would be dead? Yeah, me included. It doesn't matter how much time you would give me, I'm not solving this Rubik's Cube. Is it solvable? Heck yeah. There's people that can solve this in seconds. You see, sometimes this is, I think, how we need to view poverty. That someone in poverty has this Rubik's Cube and we're just saying, you just need to solve it. They're like, you can give me all the time in the world. I can't do this. You say, well, you know, if you just turn the right thing, you know, in the right direction and you spin it just right, and then you move the right one at the right time and in the right way, and you know, look at it and you know, make a decision, and you just keep going somehow. And I can't solve a Rubik's Cube. I messed it up myself. 10 specific moves that I memorized, and I undid those 10 moves. And I had to cover it with a towel because some kid comes by and turned this once. I was done. You see, and sometimes we go to someone in poverty and we say, you've got to do these 10 things. You do this, and then you do this, and you do this, and do this, and do them in this order, do them in this way, and don't mess up. And when it's all said and done, you're not going to be in poverty anymore. But you see, not having the pencil is a turn in the wrong direction, and everything fell apart. And once it falls apart, you can't do the 10 steps anymore. And you're twisting and turning, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And it doesn't matter how hard you try, you'll never solve it. And for us, we say, how hard could it be? And the truth is, we're kind of lucky we know our 10 moves. Poverty is not a person making a poor decision. It is about a system that they find themselves in. There are lazy people in the world. I get it. But do not use a lazy person to identify poverty in people that are poor. Because it is much more systemic than that. And we have to change the approach that we're using when it comes to poverty. Poverty is not a person, it is a system. And if you had to spend a week in the shoes of a person in poverty, you just might see getting a pencil for your kid's homework more challenging than solving this Rubik's Cube. It's not that any of the things that we're doing for poverty is bad, they're good. But they're not moving the needle either. There are more poor today than there's ever been. It's not a problem with the people. It's a problem with the system. There's a book that came out a few years back, a couple years ago now, called What I Wish My Teacher Knew. This is a picture of the cover. And in this, a teacher asked her class to write a short note about what they wished their teacher knew about them or their lives. And here's just one of them, which inspired me today, because the kid wrote this. I wish my teacher knew I don't have pencils at home to do my homework. And that little note that that kid wrote inspired me to think through what that might be and what I shared with you today. What I share with you today is just my making up of what might be. But when a kid writes that, they're writing about a system that's got a problem. Not that mom has a problem or dad has a problem. And even if you would say mom and dad are lazy, why does the kid suffer? Where is he going to get his education in a household of lazy people? He'll get the education the same way he would if he was in a household of non-lazy people that are stuck in poverty. It's not about the people. It's about the system that these people are finding themselves in. There's bad apples everywhere. All classes of people have bad apples. We're not talking about that. We're talking about poverty, those that are poor, not because they could do something about it, because it's a system they find themselves in. In the weeks to come, we are going to look at poverty in Sioux Falls, and we're going to look at what the Christian response should be towards poverty. And I want you to know that that response is not going to look anything like the liberal plan in our country today of taking from those that have and giving it to those that don't. But the answer is also not going to look like a conservative response towards poverty of tough love and of seeing poverty as a people problem. We're going to look at how to solve poverty in a helpful way and identify how many times our way of helping actually hurts those that we're trying to help. And lastly, in this series, we're going to look at the key to all of this, how to actually solve the problem of poverty and end poverty for good. But you're going to have to stick around to hear what that is. If you see some brother and sister in need and have the means to do something about it, but turn a cold shoulder and do nothing, what happens to God's love? You have means. Not that that doesn't mean financial, but please don't throw that in there. Because the means could be of addressing poverty the right way. If you have the means to do this differently than we're doing it, and you don't. We can't just say poverty is a result of lazy people. So every time I hear about poverty, I will never raise a finger for it because I'm just going to assume it's all about lazy people. I want you to know the data says that is 100% wrong. And we are called to do something. And if we have a means to do something and we don't do it, what happens to God's love? It disappears. and we made it disappear. So as the worship team comes up, maybe when I gave that data earlier, some of you got kind of weepy, you know? You emotionally connected with my data. For those of you that didn't, we have an emotional song to close with. Because whether your heart connects with a spreadsheet or your heart connects artistically in the truth of God's love and grace for all his people, and the reality that God is there and he cares in the midst of your hurt and pain, we want to at least address that and talk about it. But we can't just keep doing the status quo because it is not working. We have to do this differently. And the scriptures are clear how we're to address this. And it's going to look different than the way our country is addressing it. And I get it. Who's Hillcrest? The bride of Christ, and the gates of hell will not prevail. Let it start with us. Let it start with me. Let it start with you. And those that hurt, and those that suffer, those that experience difficulty, may they find hope in Christ and in the church in which Christ left to be his body, to do his work here on this earth. We need to see the world as God sees it. We need to let our hearts beat like God's heart beats for his people that he loves and he created. So let's connect with this as we sing together. Will you stand as we close?